What do you do if you are a college senior with good grades and a major in political science who feels this nagging attraction to medicine and not to law, which is what you originally thought you wanted to do? Or are you stuck doing data entry if all along you were pre-med but struggled academically? Is healthcare out of your reach? Do you have options if you have been in high tech for the last 4 years, successfully innovating and developing new software products, but feel empty inside? You look wistfully back on the college volunteering you did in a clinical setting. Those hours gave you a sense of purpose and fulfillment, while coding just leaves you, again, feeling empty. We're going to explore post-baccalaureate options in this, our first show of 2014. Before I introduce our guest, I would like to introduce you, our listeners, to related resources at Accepted, specifically these two free, instantly downloadable special reports: Second Chance at Medical School, the A to Z of Applying to Post-Bac Programs, and Medical School Reapplicant Advice, 6 Tips for Success. We will include links in the show notes at info.accepted.com/38 to these two resources, but don't leave yet. Stick around as I introduce our guest. I'm really excited to have Dr. Barry Rothman on the show today. Accepted consultant and former post-bac director at UC Davis, Alicia Namankar, recommended that I invite him on the show. Actually, she didn't really recommend it. She insisted that I invite him, and I'm glad she did for two reasons. One, post-bac programs are growing and helping more and more applicants get into clinical healthcare fields. According to recent data published by Kaplan Test Prep, 71% of surveyed medical school admissions officers reported an increase in the number of applicants who have enrolled in post-bac programs. And listen to this stat. 90% say that strong performance in a post-bac program improves an applicant's chances of acceptance. The second reason I'm so glad that Alicia pushed me to invite Dr. Rothman is that he has set up several post-bac programs at San Francisco State University. And while it would be an exaggeration to call him the George Washington of post-bacs, he certainly has been a leader in the field. He currently serves at San Francisco State University as professor of biology, director of post-bac programs, director of SFSU's Health Professionals Advising Committee, director of the Pre-Health Professionals Certificate Program, and director of the SFSU University Pacific Dental Post-bac Program, among other things. In May 2012, Dr. Rothman received the SFSU Distinguished Faculty Award, which is presented annually to 3 faculty members. He received it in honor of his creating the formal post-bac program, dental post-bac program, Summer Science Institute, and pre-nursing post-bac program, again, among other things. His bio is a dizzying blur of activity and titles, and I'm so pleased that he's been kind enough to take a few minutes from his packed schedule to talk to us today. Welcome, Dr. Rothman.
Thank you, Linda. I'm very glad to be here.
Great. Now, how did you get involved in post-bac education? I noticed that you spent several early years in your early in your career researching the nervous system of snails, which you actually, before we started the podcast formally, told me is really much more about learning. But how did you make the switch?
Okay, so my life has followed a fairly nonlinear career path, as maybe most people, most of the students I deal with have some bends and turns in their career path. So my career path started because I was interested in math in high school, and I thought I would be a math major. I went to college at Haverford College, which was 5 miles away from my home, but 5 light years away from my neighborhood culturally. So I grew up in a sort of lower middle class urban environment and went to a suburban prep school or snazzy private school, Haverford College, which was a wonderful education but took a long time to adjust to.
Mm-hmm.
And there I decided that math was not for me but instead biology. And I was very fascinated by the possibility of understanding biological phenomena at a chemical level. I mean, I had just never dreamed that one could understand how cells did what they did, or how things happened at a cellular level and at a chemical level. So that really grabbed me, and by the end of my freshman year, I was interested in biology. I majored in biology, and was exposed to research as an undergraduate, and thought that research was really my calling. And so when I left Haverford College, I went to Caltech for graduate school and spent 6 years there and was introduced to the nervous system at Caltech, not at Haverford. Mm-hmm. And at Caltech, I found it incredibly fascinating that one could understand how the nervous system, in other words, how we think, how we learn things, how we do things, could in some ways be attacked by understanding things at a biochemical level. And so that just made complete sense to me. I loved learning about that. And the lab that I joined used snails as a model system. Linda, you and I were talking about this before.
Right.
There are model systems in biology that are used because they simplify trying to understand what goes on in humans. So the snail has 100,000 neurons, and human beings have 100 billion. So I think the snail's nervous system is the square root of the human nervous system, and so it is much simpler to look at a snail's nervous system than to understand how people do things. So anyhow, my career stayed in the research world. After I graduated from Caltech, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston for a couple of years, and then another postdoctoral fellowship at UC San Francisco for 8 years. And so long, long, long career many years ago. And as I was going through all of that, I did well. I was able to get grants. I was able to publish papers. And I wanted to stay in the San Francisco Bay Area, so I was able to get a faculty position at San Francisco State. And during my first 8 years or so at San Francisco State, I did conduct research. And I had a lab there, and again, we published papers and got grants. But I felt by the time I had gotten tenure at San Francisco State that doing research was okay, but it really didn't tug at my heartstrings. And I always loved teaching. In fact, I tutored in high school and had my own tutoring business at Haverford College, which in some ways I put more effort into than anything else. And so I spent the next, say, 15 years teaching all up and down the curriculum, which I greatly loved. And I became a health professions advisor at San Francisco State in 1995, and I just thought, well, you know, it'll be a little sideline, no big deal. I'll take over this position, no problem. And little did I realize how much I would fall in love with being a health professions advisor. I was always interested in healthcare, and my interest in the nervous system actually, and my teaching led me to become interested in molecular medicine, how diseases work at a molecular and cellular level. Mm-hmm. And so sort of my research interests, which weren't being satisfied by conducting research, kind of moved into this area of molecular medicine and becoming a health professions advisor. And as I said before, I fell in love with it. And then, after being the health professions advisor for about 8 years, 8 years, no, 11 years, in 2006, the summer of 2006, the postbacks at San Francisco State, and at that time, the California State University was offering basically open enrollment to postbacks, mm-hmm. these unstructured postback programs, which were inexpensive and easily available, a wonderful resource for anybody near a CSU campus. So the postbacks asked me to create something that had more support, more bells and whistles, more help for them. They didn't like just sort of floating freely and not being very organized. So I created a post-baccalaureate program that charged higher tuition, although not unreasonable tuition, and I had to learn the politics of San Francisco State to get that to be passed through the Academic Senate. And in the summer of 2006, it started with a group of 18 students.
And now there's a post-bac program for nurses, there's a post-bac program for dentists, there's informal, there's formal. I mean, there's a whole array.
Things grew. I started.
Yeah, you can say that. You're like mushrooms. The floodgates opened.
When I first started running the post-bac program, I thought, sort of like when I started being the health professions advisor, well, you know, I'll get this started. It seems so administrative. I'll just get it started and let somebody else take it over. But then I realized, God, I could plan this whole thing out. I could really create a program that captured some values that I thought were really important in education. And those values, I think, could be summarized by two words, support group.
Okay.
That in my years at UCSF and then at San Francisco State, I participated in a peer counseling community. And support groups were a very big part of that. And in fact, for 30-some years, I've been a member of a men's support group.
Uh-huh.
And so I believe in support groups as a way of helping people navigate through our very complex society where family structures are changing all the time and maybe aren't so supportive. And in some ways, support groups can be very family-ish in a good way. And so I created the post-bac program using the support group model that students were encouraged to get along with each other and help each other rather than compete with each other. And I say it on my website, and I say it when they get interviewed, and we keep telling them that. And they believe it because I think many students want that, that having gone, many of them having gone to rather competitive undergraduate institutions, just don't like that. People learn much better when they feel safe.
Sure.
And so we created a safe environment with a lot of psychosocial support, with support groups actually built in, with a psychotherapist, with a learning specialist, and support of each cohort of students themselves, so that when students come to our program, they're amazed at how comfortable they are and how friendly it is and how different it, in many cases, is to their earlier experience. And I think that being able to do that, used information and knowledge and experience I had from another part of my life and brought it into the academic realm, and that was just deeply satisfying.
Sure. And first of all, pre-meds are obviously notorious for being competitive. But
yes.
I know at Accepted, I work with pre-meds. I also work with pre-MBAs. And one of the things that we've been doing the last couple of years is in response to the fact that the schools are asking for this, that some of the schools have set up what's known as team-based interviews,
mm-hmm.
where groups, they observe students in group attempting to solve a certain problem. And so we, as a service, offer mock team-based discussions. And we encourage the participants to meet offline just to help each other and support each other.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they're just, initially at least, very suspicious. They don't want to do it. And it takes some real persuasion and a little bit of nudging to get them to agree. And then they do agree. They find it enormously helpful. And, they do well in those interviews because they've been in this. That's just a mini example of what you're talking about. I think your own example is much more substantive. But it was really quite eye-opening to see how they were almost willing to forego help and support because it might help their competition eventually.
I think that's a very prevalent mindset, and different universities promulgate that more or less, depending on the structure and the personality of the university.
Okay.
But I think that many students are actually hungry for that, and when it's put up in black and white and stated explicitly, this is not competitive, we are working together, we're cooperative, that a lot of students really want this. They're sick of the the competitive atmosphere, which,
right.
you know, is not healthy for them. It's stressful. They don't learn as well. It's much better this way.
Yeah, you know, rising waters float all boats. Now, I noticed programs and, you know, on your very helpful website, which we're going to link to from our show notes, I noticed that, you know, one of the differences in the post-bac programs that you offer is that they are for academic enhancers and they are for career changers, which are the two primary categories, I guess, of pre-meds that attend post-bac programs. How do
Correct.
The programs differ depending upon the target group?
The career changer versus academic enhancer?
Yes.
Yes. So when the program started, it was just a career changer program.
Okay.
And a career changer program is for students who were not originally wanting to go to med school. So there's a subset of students out there who have finished their college degree, often were non-science majors, and went into some other area, say international relations or work for a nonprofit, something like that. And what they find is that, in retrospect, they were turned off by the pre-meds they went to school with, and also maybe scared or intimidated by some of the science curriculum. And
right.
so as they went out into their career paths, they realized that actually maybe they could take a medical career path, that maybe it's not so daunting now that they've gotten life experience and gained confidence. And so those students want to go through a career changer post-bac program where they can take all the medical school prereqs over a period of, in our program, over a period of 2 years, a little less than 2 years, and then be ready to apply to medical school. And the nice thing is that they don't have to take a bunch of other classes. They don't have to take general education classes. They don't have to take a whole large number of classes that are not relevant to medical school. So they like that because it's very time efficient.
Is it a part-time program?
I mean, it's a full-time program, but we let students be in it part-time. Some
okay.
of our students have to work
right.
and go to school, and we are just fine with that. We'll do whatever it takes to support our students so that they can be in the program. And that might just be taking one or two courses each semester while working part-time. That's okay with us. It slows them down, obviously, but if you have to work to stay alive, then
sure.
that's what you have to do. And actually, the health profession schools understand that. And as long as that's clearly explained to them, then they won't look down on the student as taking too long.
Right, right. And what about if one is participating in a post-bac program, as let's say
Linda, let me yeah. talk about academic enhancers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, right. yes. So academic enhancers are sort of the other population of students who want to go to medical and other health profession schools. They're people who tended to be biology majors and knew quite early on that they wanted to go into the health profession. However, their academic records are a little tarnished, or they're not quite feeling confident enough. They need a little more experience, or they want to take a few extra courses. And so that's a different track. So those students would be in our program for oftentimes just a year, just a few semesters. We have summer, fall, and spring semesters. And then they're ready to apply. Those with very tarnished records might need to spend 2, sometimes 3 years in the academic enhancer track.
Okay.
Now, there's an interesting overlap between the two tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So career changers need mostly prerequisites and some electives, and academic enhancers may retake a few prerequisites and take a lot of electives. So they do overlap in classes. We don't separate them. And so they get to know each other. There's definitely a slight cultural difference. The academic enhancers are feeling a little bad about not doing well. In some cases, they've applied unsuccessfully to health profession schools. And so in some ways they do form a separate community, although there's not a lot of tension between academic enhancers and career changers. They are two slightly different populations.
Okay, great. So it is possible. Clearly, depending upon how much damage was done to the academic record would influence how many classes an academic enhancer or how long they should be in the program, right?
Yes.
It's not just not an all or nothing kind of thing.
No. We try to be very flexible. A person could take one class in our program, and a person could spend 3 years in our program, and we're okay with either of those and everything in between.
Okay.
That lets our students do other things. Students who are really hurting financially might need to take some classes in a less expensive program concurrently.
Right.
Well, and as I said before, some need to work part-time just to keep up with their tuition.
Sure. Or the grocery bill.
Yes. I mean, if you're financially independent, meaning you have to support yourself, then going to school can be tough. There is financial aid available, but it's limited loans. And in some cases, when a student has used up all their federal loans, they have to get private loans. And getting a private loan depends on your age and whether you can get a cosigner for your private loan. So there are many different scenarios in terms of actually paying for the post-bac program.
Okay, great.
Now, one other thing. You use the word should take a certain number of classes and should be in the program a certain amount of time. And what we have found is that generally students listen to us.
Okay.
Well, first of all, we don't make people do anything.
Of course.
We don't force them to take classes. We actually have a lot of advising. I have a leadership team of 4 other PhDs who help run the program and help teach and take on lots of advising. And so we have very friendly connections with our students. However, they don't always listen to our sage advice. And,
I can identify with that.
It's interesting to see what happens. One of the most common confounding factors is parents who think that they know better than their students, their children, how long they should spend in school and, you know, which classes they should take. So a lot of times we're sort of having a tug of war with the parents.
Really?
With the student in the middle, trying to convince them, look, if you apply now, it's a change.